Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome back to Hawk Binge, your cruise through the mystic realms that makes up the Hawkwind discography one album at a time in the company of a long-term fan, which is me, and your returning favourite first-time listener, which is Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Andy. Welcome to season three, everybody.
Indeed. It's been a while. I believe it was the spring when we last did a full-on canon episode.
Oh, man. I went back through a couple of episodes just to try and remember how we do this. And yeah, I remember talking about spring all the way back when we were at the Xenon Codex. So although we've produced some stuff, we haven't done much in the actual timeline very recently. It's just been a strange year for it, unfortunately. So sorry to everyone who already expect a rather sporadic release schedule. I'm hoping that we can get back on track going into season three. Even the break between our last couple of episodes has been quite crazy because you and I, we were in New York because I got married.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you very much. So anyone who's wondering why I've been slightly distracted for the whole year, the challenges of trying to organize a wedding 4,000 miles and six time zones away has been difficult. So that's why maybe our schedule's been a little bit weird because my free time has been split between that and this. But now we're on the other side of that. And now I have a whole 90s to look forward to and talk to you about.
Indeed. And I was, of course, your favorite long-term fan and best man at your wedding, which was an honor. Well done. Got a good mention of Hawk Binge into the speech, which was greeted by nonplussed looks, which just made it all the more entertaining. And it's not as if nothing has happened, is it? Because we saw the band at the Royal Albert Hall, which was quite something, because you saw them obviously about 10 years ago when I took you to see them do the Warrior Tour and then the Machine Stops Tour, basically. But it was one of those where you would take me to bands you liked, I'd take you to bands I liked. So it was kind of entertaining. But then the last time you saw them, which was the first time you'd seen them live since then, was Psygnosis, which we did a podcast about, which was great fun. They sounded great and the music was great. And obviously the new album was about to hit and all that kind of stuff. But it wasn't like a major gig. I think there were problems getting there and all sorts of things. And it wasn't massively hugely attended. So it was good that you actually got to see a big gig, Royal Albert Hall, lots of people. That was fun, right?
It was. It was nice to see them on their own terms because obviously Psygnosis, they were playing with a whole bunch of other bands and that means that they don't have a lot of time to really set up a stage. They did a pretty good job, I thought, but on the whole, it was obviously they're one of a large group of bands all playing. So it slightly takes away from what they can do to own a set, and given their predisposition for the audiovisual thing, it was nice to be able to see them do what they intended. I was wondering how different it was going to be, and it actually was. We were on the floor, which is great because I think you get a nice atmosphere there. And they had videos for every track that they played, ones that I'd never seen before. They had quite the laser show, and they had this fly posted artwork all over the backstage. So they'd done a really good job to make it their own. I thought it was nice because you could drift into the music and then see what they'd done for the visuals, because they put genuine effort into all of them. And they played for almost 2 hours, I think. It wasn't a short set.
No, absolutely. Again, you kind of mind boggles at Dave's stamina, and his voice sounded really strong and it played really well. Band sounded good. There was definite professionalism in the production of those visuals. A lot of Hawkwind visuals that I've seen have been really nice but quite homespun. But these were of a slightly different character, and that was really good to see. So yeah, I was really pleased that you got to see that. It was nice for me. I saw Ian and Oz in the pub beforehand. Hello to those guys. So yeah, it was really good. If that is the last London gig, which is reportedly the case, then that's a good one to go out on. Not the only gig that we've seen, Matt. We went to Heavy Psych Sounds in Berlin. I popped over to you for that because that had some bands on there that we've talked about quite a lot on the show before. Jobia become a bit of a favorite, I think, of people who listen to the playlists that we put together on Spotify. Blackwater, Holy Light, Acid Mammoth, Dope Lord, Nebula. That was a really good set, kind of like a mini desert fest. So much has been going on. And in all of that, we've obviously been spinning Space Bandits. And because it's been such a delay, I've probably gone through three different phases of listening to Space Bandits to prepare for shows that we then weren't able to do. Mm-hmm. Probably the same for you. So when we looked at the turntable picks and the things we've been listening to, it's like it's gone through so many phases, basically, to get to this point. But what have you been spinning recently in amongst your listens to Space Bandits?
Yeah, it's gone through a whole bunch of things, but the two things which have still remained, despite all the things I've been listening to that have stuck in my head, is an older one and a brand new one. I don't know if you remember, but I think last Christmas time when the nights were drawing in, I told you about my Soft Doom playlist, which is the kind of more ambient and acoustic, but still fits into that Doomy Productions, which I like.
I do remember that.
Yeah, so this one has gone into a bit more like wistful electro. And the first artist I've been listening to in that field for me is an artist called Forest Swords. And we actually saw him play at that church in Farringdon, which is close to where we used to work.
Yes, I vaguely remember this.
We saw him play, I think this album that I was listening to, it's kind of just him and a laptop. So it's not the most riveting to watch, but to hear, I always find it absolutely mesmerizing. And in the church, I think it was very resonant and echoey and booming and very cool. The music that he creates, it's that kind of London future bass music, very atmospheric, lots of breakbeats, quite sparse, very atmospheric. But there's also big drops and subby bass lines to add a lot of ballast to everything. And he uses vocals in this very choppy way, almost like he's making tones from chopped pitch vocals rather than have someone singing. He finds someone who's speaking or singing and grabs tiny bits which are at the pitch he needs and then plays them like a piano. So it's all very strange, yet somehow very human. And it's that layer over the top of the beats that I think makes his work very compelling. He's doing a lot of TV and film composition now. And I think that makes sense given the fact that he's very atmospheric. That he has a track called Arms Open on the album Compassion, which is on Ninja Tune, one of my favorite labels ever.
Very cool. We're talking of atmospheric. I have an entirely new discovery for me, which is relatively recent in the past couple of weeks. I'm slightly obsessed with them. And that is Carter Estra, who I'd never heard of even remotely. But I was listening to Stuart McConey's Freak Zone, which I frequently catch up with. It's such a brilliant show. And towards the end of an episode, they played this track from Carter Estra called Andromeda Approaching, which is an absolutely incredible record. And I listened to the album afterwards while I was reading a book called Annihilation, which is the book of the film by Jeff Vandermeer, and it's part of a trilogy. And it has this dreamy quality, and so does the music. So it became the perfect music to listen to while reading these Jeff Vandermeer books. And it's hard to describe. They've been around for a long time. They've done a lot of albums. But if you look for them on Spotify, their most popular tracks sections, they're coming in at less than 1,000 listens. So they're not out there an awful lot, as far as I can tell. It is one guy called Richard Wileman, who plays acoustic, electric, classical, and bass guitars, keyboards, melodica, accordion, kalimba, Appalachian, dulcimer, rastrophone, whatever that is, bouzouki, glockenspiel, orchestral samples, clock, and percussion. Then there is a vocalist who basically, I think, is on one of these tracks, which is Alicia Wileman. Amy Fry, who plays clarinet, alto sax, and flute. And then a guy plays drums on one track. So it's mainly Richard Wileman, but it's described by Sid Smith, who's done a lot of King Crimson stuff, if it's the same guy, as a delightfully unsettling gothic ambience. And, you know, really lovely stuff. And I think that's a great phrase, unsettling gothic ambience. Very minimal, very atmospheric. And the track that I've selected is from the album The Time and the Stars, which is their 12th album. And it has the track Andromeda Approaches on it, which is obviously based on the forthcoming collision of the Andromeda Galaxy and our own Milky Way, which is only, I believe, at this point, 2 billion years away. So build your shelters. And it's really worth a listen. I can't believe that there won't be quite a lot of people who listen to this who won't listen to this and be as entranced as I was. It's on a label I'd never heard of either called Believer's Roast, but that is run or owned or started by Kavis Tarabi, who is now the frontman of Gong, who we've mentioned and talked about before. So links within links on that one. It's absolutely stunning. And I think you'll kind of end up deep diving through Carter Estra if you give that a listen.
Very cool.
Anything else from you?
Yeah, my second pick is from an artist called James Blake. And James Blake has been in my life musically since the early 2010s. He's famous now for being this kind of alternative pop act. But when he started getting into music, he was actually very much in the underground. He was this very avant-garde electronic producer who would put out hugely melodic EPs into the UK dubstep scene, which was normally much more dark and atonal. So he stuck out like a sore thumb, but he was very compelling because of that. And he got more popular as he did so. He kind of left that scene to go and sing soulful R&B songs and produce for artists like Beyonce. So, you know, he got very, very big. But recently he's built his own studio in LA that includes a little playroom. And he's got a lot of modular gear, which is the kind of music and instruments that I like playing with. And he made an album which was inspired by him playing with this modular gear called Playing Robots Into Heaven. It's an interesting album because it's about someone who knows how to compose, dealing with instruments which kind of want to do their own thing or don't really obey what he wants them to do. So he's got to change the way that he works in order to make music. So from my point of view, as a person who's interested in modular, it's interesting. But sonically, it's also interesting to hear those two worlds kind of collide. And I think it collides amazingly in a track called Big Hammer, which came about purely by him messing around with a few modules, and it grew into this totally weird track, which reminds me spiritually more of the stuff he was doing back in the 2010s. So this was very exciting to hear again. And it's built around this sort of slippery, slidey, slightly cheeky electro melody, which is bolstered by this huge 808 bass line. And then he just added this sample from the Ragga Twins, which rounds out the whole thing to make this very small, ridiculous, bleepy jam, which is, for me, great stuff and great fun.
Nice. Well, the other one that I've chosen goes right back to my foundation bands. And it's surprising to me, actually, that it's taken me this long to be listening to them in time to bring them as a turntable pick. So whereas Carta Estra is pretty much up to date, coming from 2016, this is from 1971 and it's Genesis. Now, we've done Peter Gabriel tracks on the playlist before. We've done Steve Hackett tracks on the playlist before, but never gone the whole hog with Genesis. But the tricky thing for me with Genesis is that when I listen to a Genesis album, it makes me listen to a lot of Genesis albums in a short space of time. I kind of splurged the discography, which means I then had to think, okay, well, I'm definitely going to put this into the playlist, but I don't know which one. So I decided to think about this from a point of view of the kind of music that we both like. And what, given that I suspect you don't know many Genesis albums, would be one that might even be something that you would listen to and go, that's really interesting. So I went with Nursery Crime, which is the first album that Phil Collins is on as the drummer. It's about 5 or 6 years before he becomes the frontman. Peter Gabriel is still singing. It's also the first album that features Steve Hackett as the guitarist. So it's kind of the first album of the classic prog lineup of Genesis. I wouldn't say it's their best album, but there's such a difference between your favorite album and the objectively best albums, I think. This is definitely one of my favorites. It has a dense wall of sound quality to it, full of mellotron and mysticism. There's a lot of storytelling. It's very otherworldly. One of my favorite tracks, Return of the Giant Hogweed, I got to hear it played live, which I never thought I would, because modern Genesis would never play. But Steve Hackett played it, so I got to hear it. And it's the first time I've ever heard tapping, which was made famous by Eddie Van Halen. But actually, Steve Hackett got there before him. But the track that I've chosen to put on to the playlist is probably the iconic track from Nursery Crime, which is The Musical Box, which pretty much has everything of early Genesis. And yeah, if there was an album that I could play you that you might enjoy of Genesis, I think it would be this one, simply because there's so much to sink into and such that kind of wall of sound thing. I could imagine this just about fitting into a Desert Fest lineup. So those are our turntable picks. This gives some context for what we've been listening to while we've been playing Space Bandits on repeat. The other piece of context that we do for anyone who hasn't heard some of the earlier shows is that we also set up the year that the album was released into. What was the musical environment that was around when the album was released? What was it competing with? What was in the charts? What was being played? Who was big at the time? So for this, we dive back to 1990. And usually I wouldn't look at musical events, just at album releases. But I read that in 1990, Eric Clapton, who I'm not a particularly big fan of, particularly now, he played 18 gigs at the Royal Albert Hall in 3 weeks. 18 shows out of 21 days at the Royal Albert Hall. That is insane. So I've included that just because my mind was blown. But 1990, here are some names that I think are going to trigger some memories. Some good, some not so good. MC Hammer, Please Hammer Don't Hurt Them. MC Hammer is 1990. The KLF, Chill Out. Sinead O'Connor, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. And we will get to the big song from that very, very soon. Robert Plant, Manic Nirvana. Depeche Mode, Violator is 1990. 90 is also a huge year for early hip hop. Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet is their follow-up to A Nation of Millions and another brilliant album there. Eric B. and Rakim, Let the Rhythm Hit 'Em. And Ice Cube's first solo album, America's Most Wanted, America with 3 Ks. So huge year for music in that particular vein. Other big debuts that year, Green Day, first Green Day album is 1990, 39 Smooth. Mariah Carey, her first album comes out that year, eponymous, that one. Kid Rock, we have 1990 to blame for that, Grit Sandwiches for Breakfast. And the Black Crowes, Shake Your Moneymaker. They went on to have one hit, I think. Dred Zeppelin, who I wouldn't normally mention because they're pretty inconsequential, but they released an album called Unleaded, and I wanted to point them out because they are genius. Dred Zeppelin play Led Zeppelin songs in reggae style. The singer is an Elvis Presley impersonator called Tort Elvis, and he's the big Elvis from his Vegas days. And he's very funny. He's got a killer of voice. So it's Elvis Presley singing Led Zeppelin as reggae. And their first album was huge at the time. Robert Plant said one of the songs on there, Your Time Is Gonna Come, was the best version of Your Time Is Gonna Come that he'd heard. Jimmy Page didn't like it quite so much, but Jimmy Page is slightly more precious about his own discography in that sense than Robert Plant. Robert Plant loved it. And I went to see them play. They played in London at what was then the Town and Country Club, is now the Forum, and they were sensational. So look that one up, Unleaded. Now I've got it in my head. It might even be on next time's playlist. Who knows? Other bands from this time, That Petrol in Motion, that feels very 90s to me. Chemi Crazy, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, The Good Son, In Spiral Carpets, Life, KMFDM, Naive. Sonia, who I'm pretty sure was a Stock Aitken and Waterman artist, had an album called Everybody Knows. The Soup Dragons had an album called Loved, Cameo, Real Men Wear Black, 808 State, United States 90. All of these just really are the 1980s to me. REO Speedwagon, who I know almost nothing about, but they have one of the great album titles, which is why it's on this list. The Earth, A Small Man, His Dog and a Chicken is a great name for an album. The Beautiful South, Choke, Whitney Houston, I'm Your Baby Tonight. Anybody out there like the Durruti column? Obey the Time, Happy Mondays, Pills, Thrills and Bellyaches, Run DMC, Back from Hell. This is the year for metal in a big way. Rust in Peace from Megadeth, Seasons in the Abyss from Slayer, and Iron Maiden released No Prayer for the Dying, probably not one of their strongest. Cowboys from Hell from Pantera, that's a huge, huge album and still influential today. John Bon Jovi releases Blaze of Glory, which is the soundtrack to Young Guns 2. So if you remember Young Guns and Young Guns 2, that was that pack of Emilio Estevez and Kiefer Sutherland and all that gang. A lighter metal, which I really hated, Magnum, Goodnight LA, Winger, In the Heart of the Young. Brilliant album from Alice in Chains, Facelift, Bob Dylan, Under the Red Sky, and Betty Boo. Boo Mania. So those are all albums released in 1990, and so many names there that just kind of scream 90s. Here are some of the hit singles, because I still think of the 80s and 90s as really the era of singles. And talking earlier of Sinead O'Connor, this is the year of Nothing Compares to You, basically, obviously written by Prince, but really made her own. Huge, huge selling single that year. Vogue by Madonna, Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice, You Can't Touch This by the aforesaid MC Hammer, It Must Have Been Love by Roxette. All of these are huge songs that are kind of just burned into your memory, and this is the year they came out. Ride on Time by Black Box is this year, Epic by Faith No More, The Joker from Steve Miller Band, all these huge songs. And it's also the year of the single greatest World Cup song of all time by England and New Order, World in Motion. despite the rather dodgy rap by John Barnes halfway through. Definitely a different league to the kind of fodder we'd had before. So that is 1990 musically. That is the world into which Space Bandits is released. And Space Bandits is released on 25th of April on the GWR label. And the band is an interesting one now. We've had a period of stability for Hawkwind. Xenon Codex was the same lineup as Chronicle of the Black Sword. There were 2 or 3 years between those albums, so that lineup had been together for quite some time. But there were several notable departures from that band. The drummer, Danny Thompson, he's gone. But really, the killer is that Hugh Lloyd Langton has left the band at this point. And he really is kind of synonymous with Hawkwind in the 1980s, as we discussed on previous podcasts, particularly the one with Oz. So that leaves Dave Brock, Alan Davey, and Harvey Bainbridge. So who comes in to the band at this point is really interesting. Simon House comes back to the band, and Matt, you'll remember him from Damnation Alley and that amazing music, brilliant keyboard player, brilliant violinist. And he comes back in, and some of the lead playing of Hugh Lloyd Langton is replaced by lead violin playing, which again is kind of that Hawkwind just doing what they need and want to do rather than going, there needs to be a guitar solo here. Somebody find me a lead guitarist. No, we'll do that with violin and do it very effectively. Bridget Wishart is probably the one that really stands out. Bridget Wishart comes into the band. She is the first female vocalist to come into the band. And it's probably the thing that hits you when you first hear Space Bandits, if you've not been prepared for it, is a female voice. Now, Bridget was around on the Free Festival scene. I'm not going to go into huge detail here because I'm about to read a couple of things from Carol Clark's brilliant book, The Saga of Hawkwind, and also Ian Abraham's fantastic book, Hawkwind Sonic Assassins. Both deal with all of this so much better than we would on a podcast. But it's worth just checking out the story of Bridget Wishart and what happens when she joins the band. She's on the Free Festival scene. She befriends the band and, as always, ends up in the band. But it's interesting to look at what she represented because she's so much more than just a female vocalist. Harvey Bainbridge says in Carol Clark's book, The Saga of Hawkwind, she was very theatrical. She was energetic, full of ideas, and she was good company. She was a bit of a loony, as we all are. Dave Brock adds that she wrote a few numbers that were really good and some great poems like The Seventh Star, which was later released on a live album, Live 1990. So from that, you get the fact that not only is Bridget a female singer, she's also writing and contributing to the songs. She's also doing spoken word pieces, and she's also very theatrical and dancing, doing performance art. So in a way, you could look at Bridget Wishart in this case as having that theatrical element maybe of a Stacia, in a completely different context, of course, but that onstage theatricality, performance, almost Peter Gabriel-esque to a degree, because she would don different outfits and headsets and get into characters of songs, which again is chronicled beautifully in The Saga of Hawkwind. So very theatrical, but also that spoken word element brings a little bit of Robert Calvert. And again, I'm not comparing the two, but it's interesting that Hawkwind has a space in the band for poetry, spoken word, and performance and characterization. And Bridget very much represents that. The other person who comes into the band at this point is Richard Chadwick, the drummer, who is still Hawkwind's drummer. And the interesting thing here is, Matt, that I remember when we talked and when we did the podcast about the Psygnosis gig, Richard was one of those that you actually pointed out. You couldn't believe he'd been in the band for as long as he has because his drumming was so powerful. And I think that Richard Chadwick, his drumming on the new on the latest album is fantastic. We commented on it on the track The Beginning that we all loved. And he is a brilliant Hawkwind drummer. But his confidence was not always at this level. He was again on the Free Festival circuit before befriending Hawkwind, ending up in the band. But there is a difference with Richard when he gets into the studio. So this, again, in The Saga of Hawkwind by Carol Clark, is chronicling Richard Chadwick's first foray into recording an album with Hawkwind in a recording studio. And she says, Rockfield was Richard Chadwick's first experience of a large professional studio. Going in to record Space Bandits, he found everything really exciting, but by the time they'd recorded the first track, he was already disillusioned. It was a big, long, very fast song called Images that lyrically Bridget had put together, he relates. It went at 174 beats per minute. I found it very difficult. I listened back and I realized I wasn't staying in time with the click track. That was a big letdown for me. I was then faced with the prospect of programming the drums, which I'd never done ever before. I was like a Stone Age man with his technology. He continues a few paragraphs later, and this is one of my favorite quotes in any book. Then I thought, I've got two options here. Learn how to play the drums properly or get into electronics. So what I did was I got into electronics, which I think is beautiful. And I laughed out loud when I first read that. So a man after my own heart, because I will cheat my way around having to learn anything properly if I possibly can. And I'm sure that we will address this because you didn't know that. There is definitely a difference, I think, in Richard 1990 to Richard, you know, maybe even the next time a few hours later. But when you're listening to the drums and we're listening to the drum programming, I think those are things worth taking into account. So this is the band, this is the lineup of Hawkwind that take to the studio and they release Space Bandits. It is co-produced with Paul Cobbold. And Paul Cobbold is actually a fairly noted producer. His Discogs list includes Sonic Attack. And I don't remember saying Paul Cobbold on the Sonic Attack podcast, but maybe we did and I've just forgotten. He is now a lecturer in sound recording, but he was in the 1980s and 90s a producer, a former bass player. There are articles about him. There are things that he's written about the art of music production. So a known producer. This isn't a self-produced album. It's co-produced. It was only on the charts for 1 week in the UK, and it peaked at number 70. So it was not some huge return to chart form. I guess at this point, it's 2 years on from Xenon Codex, which was itself 3 years on from Black Sword. So there's not a great deal coming out from Hawkwind into the public at this point. But so, yes, where we are, a relaunched Hawkwind at number 70 in the charts with Space Bandits. Matt, your hot take on this one.
Firstly, I guess we have to deal with the elephant in the room of the album, or maybe rather the absent elephant in the room, which is the lack of Brock on a lot of this album. Of all the ways I thought Hawkwind could still surprise me, this was not one of them, you know, especially as I have the spoiler alert that he's still the frontman of the band, seeing as I just saw him in 2023. You know, him being the through line of the band this far, I never assumed he'd PXR5 himself. But had I not known that and listened to the first few tracks of this album, I might have thought I was dealing with a completely different band, you know, in the 90s. So we can come back to that, I guess, track by track, but I just feel like I needed to get that out of the way at the beginning, because I'm sure there are a good few people who are waiting for me to walk into that trap. They're like a bunch of kids who just balanced a bucket of water on top of a partially open door. So this reaction is for all of you guys. I mean, like Levitation before it, I do feel like this is actually quite a headphone album. You know, I listened to it on my laptop a few times while doing work and on my AirPods, as I like to do when I walk the dogs and stuff. But I never really felt that either of them really did justice to this Hawkwind album. You know, when I listened to on my proper monitoring headphones, I got a depth of bass and detail in the layered elements that were almost completely lost by inferior speakers. So the production and engineering on this album is first class if you put it through a good sound system. So I thought that was great to hear. More generally, it feels like this album is suffering a little bit from an identity crisis. I mean, it's called Space Bandits, which feels aggressive and action-packed. The artwork, which we'll come later to, seems to directly relate to previous albums. And while you do get some of that feeling of maybe banditry in a few of the tracks, we also get a lot of odd percussive ambience. You know, sometimes you get both in the same track. So it's a hard album to fully lose yourself in, because I think sometimes it can be a little wayward and it's not really plowing a furrow. Not that it has to, but just sometimes it can be easier to fall into one of their albums. And I feel like this one was a bit hard work, as I felt like it was trying to please two sets of audiences at the same time, which then ultimately leaves me feeling a little unfulfilled completely, because I feel like it's trying to corral a lot of different listeners, which again might be to its detriment right now, given its poor reception maybe in the charts. But that being said, it's nice that they've been able to shake off a lot of the 80s-ness already as we go into the 90s, at least for me, who's, you know, not a huge fan of that sound. There seems to be a big upgrade in either the hardware or the samplers they're using, because the more electronic sounds in this album sound like they're almost headed into the kind of Chemical Breaks, early rave techno direction, with the richness and depth over something, you know, like Void City, which always felt very two-dimensional and not particularly interesting. Sorry, Oz. But I feel, I just played the album through one more time before we did this podcast. And I think that I've fallen into my own groove with it more, a couple of things still notwithstanding, but I've actually enjoyed it. And I don't know why I was tentative about Hawkwind in the 90s, maybe just because as we get further and further away from the hits from the 70s, you always kind of wonder where they're going to go. But for me, as Levitation started the 80s in an interesting way, I think Space Bandits has certainly broken into the 90s and the new decade with something to say. And I think that's very commendable. And I've mostly enjoyed the time I've had with it.
That's good to hear. I've had an interesting one with Space Bandits. The 90s albums are not ones that I've repeatedly gone back to. We're edging towards my wilderness years when I discovered grunge and went off in a completely different direction. So I would pick up the new albums by Hawkwind and I'd listen to them. And I think I saw them on this tour, but I'm not entirely sure I did. But then 5 years, 7 years, 10 years later, I wasn't going back to pull this one out to put it on. So this has been quite a journey of rediscovery for me. Like, I could have named you the track list and I could remember the songs vaguely, but I hadn't heard them. I was in an airport. This would be back in, I don't know, when we were first preparing to do this, probably back in May or something. I played it in an airport and immediately smiled, because it's just that, you know, the memory of it, the way it begins. And I kind of enjoyed it. But then as I played it repeatedly, I started to find the bits in it that I wasn't quite so keen on, started to jump out. And it's only in more recent times of replaying it that the bits that I do like have surfaced again. So I've been through a little bit of a journey with this over the past few months, as I've been kind of playing it and then playing it again and then going through it again. And I played it again this morning. And now I've kind of reached a point of being quite clear the things that I really do like and the things that I'm not so keen on. But it definitely has its highlights and it has some interesting things. And it's interesting how Hawkwind do seem to start the decades with new seasons, just like we do. So yeah, this will be a really interesting one to get into. So let's kick off, Matt, because this album starts with a splash of water to the face.
It certainly does. I've been listening to this album for a good few weeks now in earnest, as well as lightly touching it, you know, for quite some time in between the special end of the 80s podcast that we were doing. And Images has never not been hard work for me. It's a tricky one. There is a single version on the Apple Music extended album, which I did sneak one listen to, because that is 6 minutes long. And I think that actually helps it immensely.
I've never heard that.
It cuts down a lot of the lossy bit in the middle, which clearly wouldn't work so much for a single. So it makes it much more a straight driving track, which helps it a bit. But like, you know, the 9.5 minute Images to start an album, it just creates a very chewy track. I did find, actually, depending on my mood when I was trying to listen to this album, I would or wouldn't skip it, depending on if I wanted to really pay attention to the other tracks. Because for me, Images comes in, it's a big attention whore. It really wants you to listen to it. It does lots of different things, and I'm almost exhausted by the end of it. For me, it's Images and then it's everything else on this album in terms of the flow of it. So sometimes I did have to skip it just so I could really pay attention to some of the other tracks, because otherwise I do feel like it blankets everything else just with the amount of content that you have to go through with the track itself. So it starts with a guitar intro, which for me immediately falls out of time with itself. So I can't get into a groove with it. It seems to hit this predictable flow for the first two bars. Then in bar three, they add an extra note. Then by bar four, the game's over. And instead, we just fall into this sort of jittery synth line for a brief moment before the drums and guitar kick back in, having finally agreed on what time signature it's going to be in. So it's not a super great intro to really get your head into and start to ease into it. It's kind of a little lackluster. And then we get into it. And from there, it's a pretty pacey rock affair. It's got this flangey sounding guitar. It's got this light drum work. I feel like it's got an almost Lemmy low-end guitar bass line that walks up the scale to say hello before descending back down to add some growl in the bottom end. I'm very clear with it. Everything's nicely separated. So the sound sounds great. And then we get to the big reveal about 30 seconds in, which is the singer is brand new and female. And it's probably not since Curb Crawler on Astounding Sounds that we've heard female vocals on a Hawkwind track.
Yeah, and they were backing vocals at that.
Exactly. Yeah, very different. So suddenly to have a lead female over Brock, it left my jaw on the floor the first time I listened to it. And a little bit like War I Survived, I think I had to stop for a bit and readjust to this new reality that we found ourselves on. And once I got over that little shock, I don't mind the vocalist. I think she fits the vibe of the track well. There's this kind of serene lethargy to her delivery, you know, which layers on top of the more frenetic guitar and bass lines, which then give the piece this nice counterpoint. In fact, it's interesting that you said that this track was 174 BPM, because that's what 90s drum and bass was working on. And drum and bass works with very fast drum beats, but very slow everything else. Because if everything was going at that speed, it doesn't make sense. But actually, everything else is almost playing at half speed. So it's interesting that everything else is fast, but then some parts are slow to get that counterpoint. So that bit is quite intelligent in terms of arrangement. Musically, I find it very compelling. You know, I'm happy to listen to it play. And I like the switch into the chorus. You know, there's a very fast snare, which signals that everything's about to switch up. And I thought that snare felt almost electronically tight. And again, by that quote that you've got, probably it is, but it's cool and it's got personality to it. So if Richard was playing with this, then I feel like he's done a pretty good job of going from naught to professional album launch very quickly to make it. Even then, after the snare, when the pace remains the same, there's this subtle key change and the bass becomes more talkative in that part. And, you know, there's this little bridge afterwards where I guess Hugh would normally have been let loose if he was still around. And then off we go for one more round of verse before we switch things up again. And we hit this almost jazzy halftime breakdown, complete with big drum fills, which sound much more live. And then there are these large spaces between each note when they're all struck in unison. And I'm thinking we're going to dive into chorus number two, but then the whole thing switches up again and we just fall into this electronic ambient chapter. Everything I just said occurs within 2.5 minutes of the album opening. So there's a lot to deal with right away. And maybe this breakdown is an act of mercy from the band, you know, giving us time to process the Brockless beating we've just been given and the crazy speed of the drums and the music and everything. I'm not sure, but it's very welcome at that point. And, you know, it's nice. You know, there's a echoey trilling sound that sounds like some kind of space dolphin that dances over this gently howling pad that's set up home in the middle register. So not much going on in terms of the bass, but that just gives our ears a bit of a break. It's not atonal, but it's not what I would call musical. It's holding itself together, but barely, you know? Just when you think it's got nowhere to go, the vocals drift back in, just as floaty and serene as before, but now blending into this sort of vapor of sound and helping to give it a bit more of a focal point. The vocals themselves sound dissonant against everything else, which gives this very disquieting vibe. It sounds almost like a shaman casting a spell or doing some ancient ritual. You know, it's not space ritual in nature, but I feel like it could live in that world. You know, the vocals have that same detached delivery that Moorcock had in his spoken word pieces. But even though the words are being said, the music around it is building, like it's got somewhere it needs to be very soon, which you don't get in Warrior. You know, that was a lot more around the words and then it finished. But this is obviously wanting to go back to something. And then it all kind of dissipates and we're left with the memory of a saxophone far away for like a hot second. And that feels like it might be it. But then the guitar and drums burst in out of nowhere to make a big fill. And then we're catapulted back into this big rock jam from the beginning. But instead of a guitar solo, we have the violin solo, which is certainly not unwelcome. It actually reminded me more of classic Hawkwind, which is kind of nice because Simon House clearly has not been sleeping on his violin skills. I think the whole thing is very cool and it sounds great. You know, it's something we haven't heard from them in a while, so it's great to have it return. It just further perplexes me as a listener that it's back in. You know, we don't have Brock, we've got House. We've got this and this. It's all a big switch up that's just happening in real time. And then the guitar comes back in to pick up where the violin left off. I feel like this track is almost like a bored kid with a remote control just flipping between channels. It click, 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 lots of different things happening. And it's certainly not a guitar solo in the style of the 80s stuff, but it's still very animated and in this speed rock style, which is cool.
It's interesting to hear Dave play that kind of solo, isn't it? Because it's not what you've come to expect from him.
No, exactly. And I was looking at the sleeve notes to see if he was involved. So I felt like, you know, he's hiding, he's somewhere, but he's, yeah, clearly he's making his presence felt in the instrumentation and not the vocals, which was, you know, very surprising. And so I think all that's super frantic and interesting and, you know, a big counterpoint to the breakdown. And then suddenly we'd slip into the second chorus that I was waiting for like 2 minutes ago before the big breakdown. And then the energy's back even more. There's noodling and craziness all over the top. It sounds almost like what I hoped the first album from Hawkwind was going to be, you know, in terms of all this noodling and craziness, but sounding really, really good. So I actually really like that original updated feeling. And then there's a part where the drums stop and everything starts to spiral out into silence. And there's a big kick fill coming back in. The first time I listened to this, I thought, oh, wow, that's a really cool way to launch into track two. But then psych, it's actually round three of track one. And we go around again for one last verse and chorus before finally we feel like we've been dragged under the water. I feel like I've just described that track rather than related to it, but I feel like just describing it is pretty long and tedious. And that's how I ended up feeling about it when I listened to it. So I guess it's kind of appropriate. It's just a lot and it feels very strangely arranged. Like it is three tracks that have been squished together. I don't know, for all the listening and all the attempts I've had to meet it halfway, I always finish this track feeling kind of annoyed with it. It's twice as long as most things on the album. And while there are moments of greatness in it, which I do like, I just find overall its length and unpredictability means that as a first track, I find it much harder work than I really want it to be to really listen to it. And like I said, because of that, it does feel like it takes up a lot of my attention and my mental exhaustion is high after that track finishes. So yeah, it did end up getting skipped occasionally and is unlikely to be my pick for the playlist because of that. And you know, lyrically, it's not bad. Like I said, I think the singing's nice. I think the lyrics work. Personally, I'm not a big fan of Crazy Fool because I feel like craziness is already part of being a fool. And, you know, while I know it's not a phrase that Hawkwind invented, as a devout podcaster editor, I'm naturally against trying to say the same thing twice. So I always find that slightly annoying. But I think the rest of the lyrics stand up as an interesting story. I'm impressed by parts of it, but overall kind of not as into it as I wish I could be. And I think that's how Images eventually leaves me.
The bit I love with this is the opening minute and a half, 2 minutes. It does feel like we're back sweeping the cobwebs away. Big splash. This is who we are now, in your face. And it opens up with Bridget and it's all that energy. If it went through the middle lull and then came back and then ended, it would be a really, really good opening track for the album. But because it meanders for so long, thinks it's coming back, doesn't quite, then does. It's like a song that has multiple false endings. When the first time it happens, it's, oh, good one. But the third time it happens, it's like, I want the next track now. It's interesting you say that it feels almost like Dave isn't there, because the thing that I'm hearing so much in the first 2-3 minutes of this song is the bass. It's such a driving bass song. And obviously, Alan Davies has been in the band for the last two albums. But this is almost like he's really conjuring his inner Lemmy at this point. He really drives this song. It's frenetic. And I really like that. I'm interested to hear that 6-minute version of it, because I have a feeling that might become my favorite version of it. So yeah, I'd share the feelings of it being meandering. To me, it is one of the ones that I feel stronger about positively, but it doesn't quite reach the loftier elements of the album because they don't really quite sort out what the structure of this thing should be. Interestingly, two albums you've mentioned so far were Astounding Sounds, Amazing Music, and also Levitation, because in Ian's book, Hawkwind, Sonic Assassins, he talks about this, and this is obviously quite a big one for him. So he says in his book, the opening salvo, Images, absolutely sets the album up and tells you, like Astounding Sounds and like Levitation before it, things have changed again in Hawkwind land. It's every bit as startling as Reefer Madness and Levitation were as Gambits, and where it moves into the atmospheric tribalism of Black Elk Speaks, which we will come to next. But you can see that this is something that Ian is obviously very into, and you hear a lot of positivity around this track. And I share that positivity with the track, but not for the entire duration of the track. And I think that's the thing. But it's definitely announced itself. And I like the fact that Bridget is so much a huge part of this as the new voice. Great that you you said that your jaw was on the floor, because I've had to try for the last 2 years to make sure that you didn't learn that this is what happens on this album, so as not to dilute this. But it turns out, again, this is from Ian's book, the lyrics were derived from a song Bridget had written whilst a member of a band called Next Year's Big Thing. And for Hawkwind, she rewrote them, adapting and adding to them to suit the song. The chorus was new, as were the spoken words. So this is very much one of the big Bridget contributions, for sure. And it's great that they used it to open the album with.
Is there anything, either in your knowledge or anything that you've read from our books or anything, as to why Brock stepped away from the mic for this album?
No, honestly, I think when Hawkwind finds someone they like and they come into the band, they just do what it is that they do, and she sings. So Dave doesn't. I tend to think that Dave sings the songs that he really wants to sing. When there isn't another singer, he'll sing all of them. You know, in the past, we've had some Nick Turner, obviously Lemmy with Silver Machine. Calvert obviously took the mic for the entirety of the Calvert era. He was basically the front man singing. So I think Dave is always there to do the vocals if needed or if he really wants to. But I don't get the impression that doing the vocals is something that Dave is precious about. It's not like, no, I am the singer of this band. I don't think that's ever really been the case. So Bridget comes in and Bridget sings and Bridget writes. That's what Bridget does.
That's interesting. I think I've misjudged Brock a little bit from my estimations of, you know, the snatched bits of lore that I do get. I always thought he was a little bit, you know, like, he's certainly had little megalomaniac episodes, let's say, I think sometimes. And I was wondering whether or not at this point, you know, with things like PXR5 and with his attempts to do his own albums and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. whether or not he was more like, actually, you know, I am the person who stands at the front and everything else is built around me. But the fact that he's happy to bring someone in and, you know, not dismiss someone because they sing is refreshing for me, you know, and it's nice to be able to think of him in a different way, probably more charitably than maybe I was painting him.
He's definitely the leader of the band, like, mm-hmm. without question. All of that was resolved albums and albums ago. And perhaps there is a security in that that means that you're very open to people coming in and doing new stuff. But it always feels that way to me, that people have come into Hawkwind because there's a chemistry there, probably literally as well as metaphorically. And then they've just contributed whatever it is that they contribute to it from there. And that with the music, there isn't that much in the way of territorialism.
That's cool. I think there's also, Brock couldn't have done this song.
No.
That wouldn't have worked out. So it is cool that for this song to exist, he had to take a step back and did. I mean, even though I'm not clearly the biggest fan of the song, that bit I do like. So it's cool that they were able to make that happen by moving the band around as they needed. So that was cool.
And he plays the rhythm guitar and does his little lead bit in there in that kind of middle section. But that's not the thing that stands out from the track, for sure. Oh. Talking of some nice little bits of guitar in the background, Black Elk Speaks takes us somewhere very different. It is, by the way, a sample of historian John Neihardt reading from his book Black Elk Speaks, which is the testimony of Black Elk as given to John Neihardt.
Interesting, because I was assuming this was a sample of what I assume was some kind of Native American doing some rite or prayer or mm-hmm. something like that. And it's interesting that we have Black Elk Speaks here named after the sample. And then, you know, in some of the more recent albums, and I'm assuming probably somewhere in between there and now, there are other tracks which are called after the sample that they've built things around. So clearly they are a band which go away and find things that they find interesting and then build tracks around them. I find it interesting to find what Hawkwind find interesting, you know, what they want to build a track around, you know, whether or not it's a Aldous Huxley recording or whether or not it's a Black Elk or anything like that. So I always look forward to these on new albums to see what they've found and what they want to bring us as an anchor for their ideas. And I saw that Brock was credited as a writer on this, so I was aware that he was involved in it somehow. But again, this is a Brockless track in terms of the vocals, because it is just a big sample with a little bit of, I'm assuming the female singer again doing that little B section. Yep. I think this track's very nice. If you ignore images for a second and start with this track, it works for me. It's got this really nice opening with a deep sub bass and this interesting metallic knocking that beats this steady rhythm with a little shaker on top. The percussion is somewhere between tribal drumming and an internal combustion engine. It sounds very programmed, but it still has this rhythm to it, which again sounds quite soulful and sounds like it's treating this native vibe with some respect and carrying it through beyond just the sample. So I always think that's a really nice start. Again, it's a weird time signature for me to keep hold of. there's extra drum elements that come in, but they seem to come in whenever they feel like. So I find it hard to get into a groove necessarily with it from that point of view. But as soon as the vocal comes in, I just listen to that and just let everything else wander around the vocal and use that as my main point of interest. While I don't really know much about where the sample comes from or the book or the story, it feels suitable for Hawkwind. You know, they're talking about Star Nations, the mysterious one who rules over the universe. So for me, the content checks out. I can definitely see that it's the kind of thing that Hawkwind could get inspired by. And then we just build around this. And when we get to the complete instrumentation, we have more like what I thought the album would contain, which is, you know, deep strummy bass lines, that slightly far away spacious guitar noodling with this little rasp on it still. So it's not too clean. It's still quite melodic. You know, it's not atonal. It's not harsh. It's quite uplifting, I'd say, in its overall tone. After the first pass of the sample's done and we're back to that spoken word from the first track, and that sounds like original lyrics from Hawkwind, I feel like it's not another sample. It's like them just adding to it. So, you know, again, it's not like Warrior. It's something new. It is dramatic and theatrical. And to your quote before, that makes perfect sense. But it's still more of a driving track. You know, we haven't descended into pure swirly ambience. It's more like something which is being added to this slight breakdown, but it's still very rhythmic, still very driving. So we're not into a soundscape, we're into a different space. And the guitar's swapped for this large, more flangey sound, and the bass is still there keeping up this pace. So even the drop down still keeps its intensity, and you still feel that tribalism to it with that bang, 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 which goes through the whole thing. And while it's not as intricate in terms of the amount of instrumentation we have, I still think it's an almost deceptively detailed track. Because every time I feel like it might be going on a little too long, I hear this new piece of jangling percussion or something which pricks up my ears again. So for all its sloppiness in its arrangement, it does a good job to hold my interest, you know? So I do think there's a soul in it. It's not too electronic. It's not too by the bars, which, you know, is the kind of thing which I always thought Assault and Battery was always a victim of, you know, that kind of thing. I like the symmetry of the track as well. It starts and ends on this rapid thud that sounds like, you know, that hammer on a large slab of iron or something. And it gives the piece a feeling of coming into existence, exploring itself, going out of existence, returning back to where it came from. Almost that idea of when a car drives past and you get that Doppler effect whoosh. It's almost like that in song form. And so, yeah, I'm left feeling pretty satisfied with this. I think it's wonderfully produced. It's rich. It's quite evocative with the sample that they found. It feels, again, more 90s than 80s. And this is one of the tracks which made me feel like their production has shed a lot of the 80s-ness, which might have been stuck on its shoe as it crossed decades. But yeah, this one gave me a lot of confidence in what the rest of the album was going to be.
Yeah, same. To me, this is perfectly placed as the middle track on side one. If I'm thinking about how I would reorder the album with regard to some feedback that I would have, this track would always be the second track on side one, particularly after an energetic, chaotic thing, which is Images. And the way that they build a background around that sample, I mentioned the nice little guitar-y bits that come in that Dave is doing. I really like those. I think the spoken word bits that Bridget add in, the magic of the ground, magic of the earth and all of that fits beautifully. So you come out of Images and need to be reseated to a certain degree. And this completely does that. And quite often when I've been listening to this one while I've been out and about with the headphones on, I've had to go back and replay it because I've almost zoned out. Not like going to sleep or anything, but I had to go back because the quality of the voice, I love a good speaking voice, a good reading voice. And it is, as you say, very, very, very Hawkwind. It is the countryside, the woodland, the forest, the open skies. It's the anti-city thing that they're very much standing for on quite a lot of the album, to be fair. And obviously you can see that in the imagery of the artwork that we'll come to as well. So yes, I really like this. It's not like anything else from anybody, really. So it really does stand its ground. That drum pattern that sets down is kind of the stereotypical Indian drum pattern. If you like watch an old Western and someone goes, oh no, Indians, that is the drum that you will hear. But maybe that's because it's authentic. Who knows, right? And in that case, happy days. It certainly doesn't have any negative impact on me. It just occurred to me that maybe it wasn't particularly inventive, but maybe it doesn't need to be. Just being minimal and holding its ground and holding that beat and laying down a foundation for the sample to be played over the top and the band to come in with bits of sound design and atmosphere, it does its job perfectly. So yeah, absolutely agree. And we close out side one of the vinyl with a track by Alan Davey, which is Wings, which is obviously a very thematic track. I don't know if you'll remember, Matt, but there were huge news at the time about massive oil spills. I think ExxonMobil happened around this time. And I remember all of the newsreels would have groups of volunteers on the beach taking birds out of the sea covered in oil and all of that kind of thing. So very timely in terms of the message of this track.
Yeah, I do remember when I was a kid seeing birds on beaches being covered in oil that couldn't swim or fly away or do anything on the news and feeling very bleak about that. So yeah, I think this is a nice 1-2 from Hawkwind right now. Also, the very end of Black Elk Speaks, we get some of Hawkwind's famous bird noises, which actually then works into this transition. I guess having bird noises on a track called Wings makes sense. But again, it felt like going back to something very familiar with Hawkwind using birds, because we've heard them a lot, which is cool. The track overall is kind of an audio puzzle in that the production doesn't sound overly 80s to me, but the actual sound of the track feels like it could be in an 80s movie. I think it might be the way that the track keeps resolving itself harmonically at the end of every fourth bar. There's the feeling of all the elements coming together to make kind of one note feels quite an 80s vibe. And I feel like as well, some of the keyboards they're using makes it feel a bit more 80s, considering that the last track didn't feel very 80s. This one suddenly does again, which is kind of strange, but there's lots of great and familiar stuff in this track. You know, the drums are a classic kick snare affair and sounds like it's going at quite a pace, even though the track feels quite slow because everything else again is moving at a much slower pace, a bit like Images. There's this counterpoint between the percussion and everything else, which is really nice. So again, nice bit of arrangement. I guess for me, it's one of the incarnations of space rock, you know, the feeling of swirliness in the instruments while the percussion keeps a more aggressive pace to stop it feeling too much like a soundscape or just a jam session. So this feels like a Hawkwind track. It's just funny that it sounds more 80s again, but I still like it, even though, you know, I'm normally predisposed to not be so into that sound just personally. But, you know, the track itself, the birds give way to this strange sort of space helicopter noise and this eerie descending string. And then we have about 30 seconds of weird electro noodling before the drums and bass lines show up to corral the whole track into an actual track, you know, and off we go. I'd say from the first time I heard this track, I was into it. The synthy pad that forms the main melodic line is rich and textural, and there's a lot of movement in it, and there's this rhythmic pulse that matches the kick drum, so it feels like it's very animated. It's not just someone leaning on a key, which is great. And the bass guitar, a bit like the previous track, it reminds me a bit of the Do Re Mi album. You know, it's not just giving some ballast in the low end, it's very much doing its low end guitar thing to create a lot of interest. And you know, it is still very Lemmy-ish. I've got that in my notes even. So I think I completely agree with what you said in terms of what the bassist is doing in this track, and I think largely in this album. When the lyrics come in, they just float over the track like a pad does. You know, they don't take over the track. They just become another element, more like something we got on the chorus of The Only Ones or something. Definitely some processing on the vocals to get that effect, but it works really nicely to keep it feeling wistful and melancholic, which is what the track is going for. I think if the vocals were more shouty or natural or accusatory, it wouldn't work so well. I think the fact that there's a softness to it means that what they say cuts a little harder, which is good for what the piece is trying to do. I don't know if this is Brock singing. It doesn't sound like him to me.
No, it's Davey and Bridget doing the harmony.
I didn't think it was him, but I was almost wondering if it was, just so I could get him into this, you know, because otherwise it's otherwise he's out 3 for 3, and I was like, oh god, what is going on here?
Yeah, I mean, he's coming, don't worry. Mm-hmm.
Oh no, there's definitely a bit where he makes himself very well known.
Absolutely.
But I wasn't sure, because sometimes when he sings, it's not as obvious it's him. So I was wondering if it was him on this or not. Just because of the processing, sometimes you lose some of his twang.
Absolutely. And this is an entirely Alan Davey credit for writing this. Yeah. I have to say, it's not one of the tracks that I really go for on the album. I love the sentiment. I love the lyrics. I think the lyrics are great, and the message, which makes me feel guilty then for not really liking it, because I really want to like it. But I really don't like the drum pattern, because it's just boom-tish, boom-tish all the way through. Mm-hmm. I wish it was doing something more inventive at that point. But I guess maybe that was just where Richard was at the time. But I feel that that holds it back, because it goes on for the entire length of the track. And the track, therefore, never really takes off. Pardon the pun. it just stays in that mode pretty much throughout. After the chaos of images and the hypnotic element of Black Elk Speaks, I kind of wanted a stronger end to side one. And if side one had a stronger end to it, it would feel like a really strong side to an album. Because I find that Wings is quite difficult to go through the whole lot of it, the side kind of ends on a, I really want to flip the vinyl over at this point, kind of a feeling for me. So I've never really bonded with Wings in the way that I wanted to. And I don't think it came out necessarily the way Alan wanted it to. I think he wanted it to be darker than it is. In one of the books, he talks about the fact that it feels more upbeat than he intended it to. But yeah, so you like this one more than I do.
I guess so. I don't mind the drums doing what it's doing because I thought, given the person who wrote it, I thought actually the tension and resolution of this is in the music. I feel like the drums are much more of just a metronome, just letting us know that we're going forward. It's certainly not doing much more than that, but I didn't mind that because for me, the music floats along for like four bars or so on this kind of same chord to let the lyrics go. And then they kind of fall into a minor chord for two bars. And then over the next two bars, they resolve it, but still keeping that wistfulness intact throughout. So even while the resolution is actually quite satisfying, it doesn't break us out of the sober demeanor. It could have been darker for sure, but I feel like it still does quite a good job of maintaining its slight feeling of stress throughout it. But it does it in a way which is quite musically coherent. You know, like we still return to the sad state of affairs, even though we've just dropped a little bit, we've come up, we're still back to where we were. You know, it's more of the out of the frying pan and into the fire in musical form rather than it feels like it's actually hopeful or there's a much better way of resolving it. I also feel like the bass line does a good job of helping making these changes felt with this rich twanginess and this much more slide between the notes. I feel like it just keeps that languid feel, which again, I took it to be this almost odorism that you get when you watch this on the news because not much is being done to help. And I felt like the fact that the track is almost not doing much to help apart from point it out, I thought was actually quite smart because I thought that was a reflection on the coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And while again, it's kind of repetitive in that way, there is extra things going on, you know, occasional shakers and drum machine hi-hats, there's aeroplanes flying overhead. So I do feel like it adds a little pace to it. And I feel like it's got quite a lot of musical confidence to it. I feel like everything acts like it has a right to be there and they all interact with each other for me quite pleasingly. And I think the lyrics, like you said, it could be argued that the concept of Wings is a little played out. I think Mr. Mister probably put a stake in that idea's heart with Broken Wings. You know, nothing's going to really top that. But because it was a news article and because it was quite timely, I do think that it's a spirited attempt of painting a picture with words with the lyric writing. For me, the line, "Now their wings are soaked in oil," is just fantastic. It's one of those times where Hawkwind can pen in a line something which takes me back to something which I remember. Plus, staying true to Hawkwind's track record of pointing out climate disasters, human irresponsibility. I get this idea of whoever they're talking about is in real distress and it's probably our fault. And, you know, I feel like that's the thing that does make you feel guilty about it. I can't be sure if they're actually talking about birds exactly, or if it's a more metaphorical thing, or if they're doing that thing where it can be seen both ways. Because, you know, we have underneath the iron bird, their song cannot be heard, above the human sound, above the poison ground. While we have poison ground there, and therefore that could be oil and they can't fly anymore, we also have the iron birds and the human sound, which feels like it's a larger thing about noise drowning out bird song, about planes drowning out ecosystems and that kind of thing.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So the bird flight and human flight, I feel like while we have the very clear oil-soaked birds, we have then the larger human encroachment onto wildlife and stuff. So I think there's quite an intelligent piece on the whole. It's probably the first thing they did that felt like it was an 80s, 90s odd mishmash. But I think on the whole, I pretty much like it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. We are screwing it up for the birds and for our enjoyment of the birds at the same time. And your take on Wings is definitely much more sophisticated than my own. So I'm happy that this is me not connecting with the track rather than the track not being good. I can't change suddenly how I feel about it, but I'm happy that this is a me issue rather than a Wings issue. And who knows, maybe the next time I hear it, I will come to it slightly differently. Who knows? What we do find is that we flip over the vinyl and the second half of this album begins, and it's another big splash of water in the face, isn't it? Hello, Dave.
Absolutely. It's a big change of pace, isn't it? I think this has quite a Do-Re-Mi vibe to it with its driving rock from the get-go. And, you know, we've swapped birds for motorbikes for the intro this time. But just like the previous track, there is this bit of noodleage before the track kicks off and drags us along with it. It's shorter this time, but it's still there. The main thing I get when I listen to this at the beginning is that there's some kind of effect on the drums, like a very close delay or something that makes them sound like they're echoing about. And as a DJ, this always makes me anxious because this is the sound you get when you're mixing records and they start to fall out of time with each other and you get this clattering sound, which can really kill a dance floor dead. So as soon as I hear that, I get PTSD from hearing that in speakers. So I think they're just trying to be cool with it. But just unfortunately for me, it kind of freaks me out. But I don't have to deal with it for long because, you know, the vocals slam in and then they take all the attention. I can ignore it. And yeah, for the first time I hear this track, I thought, oh, it's B-side Dave coming in for the second side. It's very nice to hear him, and he's certainly coming out swinging because it's a pretty timeless bit of Hawkwind rock, I'd say. If it had been in Sonic Attack or something, I wouldn't have been surprised, you know, or maybe it would actually have to have been after Choose Your Masks, because as the lyrics tell us, when it comes to the light, if you want to get into it, you've got to get out of it.
Exactly.
You know, I think the lyrics are cool. Like, they feel pretty Hawkwind-esque in their delivery, and they have that relative simplicity, but very compelling because of that delivery. You know, it's all out of something, into something. As I said before, on tracks at this speed, sometimes you don't need to be that clever with the lyrics. You just need to get it because you're trying to keep up. If you need something to shout at the top of your lungs, being into and out of things makes perfect sense. So no notes there. The lyrics and the instruments, they actually kind of share equal billing in this track, I think, because between each verse, there are large gaps where the guitar and I think what sounds like the distorted violin can show off with some kind of screamy solos. And this is the first time where I was thinking, is that a process guitar or is that a violin? I think it must be the violin that's sharing top billing on this, which is cool.
Yeah, there's a bonus track, which is a different version of it, where it's just the violin, I think. Mm. This, I would say, is probably the big track, capital B, capital T, of the album. There was a live set of the tour from this that was released that was called Out of the Shadows. And given that I said I hadn't revisited this album an awful lot in the years since being into it around the time I bought it, I have actually gone back to play this track many, many, many times. I'm a huge fan of this track. I love the lyrics and the delivery of the lyrics. And then the fact that the chorus is effectively a little guitar piece. And I love the fact this is Dave, because I'm pretty sure that if I didn't know, I would have assumed that that was Hugh playing that. And there are some lyrics in here that I love. Out of the nameless, onto the front page, out of the basement and onto the stage, things like that. Yeah, I love this. My only problem with this track is that the part of the track that I think is the absolute bomb doesn't last very long. You get chorus, verse, chorus, verse, and then you never get it again. You get them going off into the instrumental bit, and then when it could come out of the instrumental bit and go back into it for a climax, it kind of ends with it going down into that jazzy halftime and then out of the shelters under the bomb, and it then goes into the big kind of experimental piece that follows, which is an excellent segue, but it's slightly annoying because I was ready for the big bit to come back in. So almost it's the reverse of Images, in as much as with Images I kind of needed it to stop earlier and maybe only have a second go round rather than the third go round. With Out of the Shadows, I really want to go round that bit again because I just think it's that good. So yeah, I love Out of the Shadows, but I have to treasure it while it lasts, because that punchy opening bit doesn't stay too long. You get two rounds of it and then it goes instrumental and then into its sound design ending.
You could probably get one more go out of it. I'm wondering how many inters and outers we have in us, in our patience as listeners, because I think right now it's a good amount of things that they are into and out of. Mm-hmm. Maybe adding too many might be a little bit too much. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it would be interesting to have found out.
I guess it's different depending on whether you're listening to it as a song, which is how I've come to it most, mm-hmm. because I've gone back to listen to this song because I wanted to hear it, as opposed to hearing the song in the context of the album, which is what we're doing. In the context of the album, you could definitely say that it works really well as it is. But if you do what I've done, which is to go, God, I love that song, I'm going to back and listen to it, then you want that initial bit to come back round. So that's an interesting thing, actually, and we're very much an album podcast. So I'm happy enough just to accept that it does its job for the album really well as it stands. But yeah, this is definitely the highlight for me so far. And given that I was slightly underwhelmed with Wings, this needed to happen for me to re-energize and reconnect with it.
It's interesting for me because it feels like it could have been a very basic song in terms of we can just say outro and intro a bit, thrash about a bit with our instruments and then be done. But actually, when we do get to the jazzy halftime piece, the quality of the track is different. It almost sounds live. There's suddenly a lot more echo on the drum kit. It actually sounds like maybe a different drum kit altogether. You know, the snare sounds completely different. The hats have a different tone. The bass line is way more fuzzy. It might just be because that's the first time we've really been able to hear it clearly. For the most of the track, it's very much fighting for its life under everything else that's going on. But when it has a chance to come up, it feels a lot more drivey and buzzy. So it feels like the B section has been spliced from a completely different take, which is kind of amazing. They didn't need to do that, but it really changes the whole timbre of the piece, you know, with the chord stabs and the guitar. They're super clean and groovy, gives the space for the bass to join in. So, you know, it's this nice addition. There's also then some audience applause at the end of the breakdown, which adds to this feeling that it could be live, but somehow the applause sounds more like a theater audience than a gig. So I'm wondering if that's even a sample which they've added onto it.
Yeah, you could be right. And interestingly, in Ian's book, Richard Chadwick describes Out of the Shadows as an anarchist's manifesto. And I had always taken that to be him commenting on the lyrics, but maybe he's commenting on the way the track is constructed. Who knows? But yeah, that breakdown is nice. I like the drums in that. I like the fact that the drums aren't overly flowery and overly complicated. It's nicely where it needs to be. And that gives, as you say, the space for Alan to play a nice little bass guitar break at that point. Yeah, it is a good one. It is nice. All of the different elements are good. There's no part that you want to leap over. And it doesn't test your patience at all or outstay its welcome. In fact, as I said, I could do with it being a bit longer. But at the end of it, it does segue into a kind of sound designy piece, which again is Alan Davey. It's a big Alan Davey experimental piece called Realms.
So yeah, we get the last little bit of lyrics where you get bomb and we go bomb, 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 which is fun. It just adds to the surreality of the ending of that track, which then heralds in this very alien film soundtrack sounding synth, which takes us into the next track. And this is where I was saying that Hawkwind feel like they're covering all bases with this album, because they're like, right, we need a creepy soundscape. Let's make one, because we've been very rocky and electronic-y until now. Soundscapes are always a pain to describe because, you know, if they're doing their job correctly, they're creating sounds you've not heard before. So there's only so much you can do to really describe what you've been listening to, you know. And I would say this one starts off sounding like a church organ being pushed through an industrial threshing machine, then ends off sounding like a double bass slowly drowning in treacle. So I don't know if that helps anyone listening.
Do you want to know how this was done?
I would love to.
So Davey says in Ian's book, all there is in Realms is my vocal and bass guitar and a good tab of acid. I did it in one night, and when I got up the next morning and played it back, there was this really great film track music, but I've never worked out how I did it. There's some big reverb backwards section, and it tails off. So there you go. Alan doesn't know how he did it either.
He probably didn't do what I said, but it sounds like that. But, you know, the fidelity of the track's really nice, and it's very rich and deep. I feel like it's played a little haphazardly. I like my soundscapes to be a bit fuzzy around the edges. While it gets to that in the second part with the aforementioned double bass part, the organy sounding keys come and go in a way which don't allow me to fully immerse myself. They feel a bit played, where I like things to be a bit more slippy, a little bit more organic or fadey when it comes to soundscapes. So it's a difficult one. It's one of the shorter tracks on the album. It's a soundscape, so it's hard to describe. I don't mind it, but I consider it the other half of the pace-killing sandwich that Images sets up. I feel like those two tracks I could nix and have a much tighter album personally. And then we go on to the last two tracks, which I think are much more interesting.
I really do like Realms, and I have a suspicion. I honestly can't remember, but my suspicion would be when I first bought this that Realms would have just been something that happened and I wouldn't really have engaged with it very much. Because this kind of thing is something I've got into pretty much since I've known you, these past 15 years, whatever it's been, when we've got more into experimental sound design, all of that side of things is something I've got into that I wouldn't have been into in 90. But now I actually really like this. I sink into it. And I like the fact that it's a man in a studio with a big tab of acid who can no longer remember how he did what he did. Because although there's no acid involved, when I listen back to stuff I've done 2 years ago, and I think I should play around with that, and then I realize that I'd have to relearn how to do what I did because I've completely forgotten. So I like that, and I like Realms. And as a 1-2 with Out of the Shadows, given to your point how they end Out of the Shadows specifically to really segue into Realms without there being a break, it's much less throwaway to me now than I think it would have been first time round.
I like that you can empathize with the process as well.
Yeah, exactly that. And we get then to Ship of Dreams, which is the Dave Brock song. He is the only one credited on Ship of Dreams.
Yeah, we flow again out of the previous track into this one. And who is sailing in on the Ship of Dreams? It's definitely Dave this time. Absolutely certain of it. The shouting of the lines, "You out there might try to ask a question about your daily tasks," is delivered in that unmistakable, you know, Southeast England twang that he has. So, you know, nice of you to show up, Dave, on the penultimate track of the album properly. Even though he's been shouting in the previous one, this is definitely the Davey track to me. So, you know, the question is, was this a good track to come in on and steal the scene? And I would say possibly. It's a slow burn for me, this one. For the first third, it's a very simple drum beat, a spiky, artificial bass guitar sounding bass line, a light bit of sound effects over the top and the vocals. It's very light compared to what we've been used to in the album up until now. So this leaves me listening to the lyrics quite a bit, and I do find them a little lacking. It's pleasantly abstract in its nature, but it doesn't draw me in as much as other Hawkwind ideas have done before. It has the heads issue for me, where they repeat a line which is clear missing a word. They keep saying "it goes nowhere, not all it seems," which, like heads, rubs that mistake in my face a lot, and I find myself getting quite aggravated by it. Even if I just try and put a bit of punctuation in there or something, I can't make "it goes nowhere, not all it seems" make a huge amount of sense. So yeah, for me that's always slightly aggravating. And while it's repeating this flagrant disregard for the English language, underneath it, the instrumentation has been preparing this stealth attack that creeps up on us with this much more aggressive full guitar line, this more animated actual bass guitar, and even this violin and air raid sign. So suddenly there's this whole like neatness coming up, and you know, the percussion sounds really great. There's this scrapey wooden sound that comes in at the end of every bar that does a good job of catching my ear, which I really like. Hawkwind again showing some really nice extra percussion beyond the drums, which I always really like from them. Like the first track, I'd like it shorter. I think even though it does a good effort to become more interesting as it progresses, I still feel like it's a little thin by the end of it. I feel like this would be more welcome on like 25 Years On or Church or something, you know, because everything's been quite sonically rich up until now. And it's just not as detailed as some of the other things for me, sonically, linguistically, conceptually. So I do feel like, all things considered, Brock should have probably jumped ship and joined the band earlier.
It's really interesting you make the comment about Church or 25 Years, because in my more recent listens to this album over the past week or two, I really like this track. I've kind of connected with it, which I think is a bit odd because I think most people would regard it as a bit of a meh track. Wouldn't hate it, but it's not like a standout. I actually really like it. But the sound of this, do you remember when we talked about Xenon Codex and I mentioned that there was a Dave solo album called Agents of Chaos? Agents of Chaos kind of sounds like Dave mucking around in the way that he did with Church of Hawkwind. This feels like something he might have had. I mean, I've no idea, but he might have had this written about that time and recorded it, because this is the sound of that album to me. But I like that sound, and I like the fact that we come out of Realms, which is quite dense and rich, and we end up with the beginning of this with something which is very stark and quite cold. But I like the rhythm of it and the sounds of it. They are very minimalistic, as most of the rhythms on these are. And it's a classic Dave delivery, exactly as you say. And I just find myself going with it. And I think this is one of those tracks that I connect with much more now than I probably did first time round, when it probably felt like a little bit of filler to me. But now actually it's something I look forward to. So yeah, it's going to be really interesting actually with the feedback that we get and some of the people who write to us about their experience of these albums. Because with this one, there are some things in here which could very much go either way with everybody. And that includes the last track, TV Suicide, which is a Harvey Bainbridge piece.
Ship of Dreams ends on this bubbling underwater sound and we fade nicely into the last track. And I would say that TV Suicide is awesomely weird. To me, It sounds like what Good Evening might have sounded like after a few years of intense therapy. You know, like, so, you know, I feel like because of that, we're left with a Hawkwind think piece to round out the album. Maybe they've taken what they learned a bit from Good Evening and evolved it, which I really like. It's got this Hawkwind style music concrete to the intro, you know, as we build this world full of half heard whispers, snatches of sampled dialogue over this quite cool beat, which has this very metallic knock acting as a snare, which always pricks my ears up immediately. I don't know fully how to articulate this or justify it properly, but this feels arty in a Some People Never Die kind of way. Something about the quality of the instruments, the disquieting bass tone under it all, it all serves to create this sonic architecture around you rather than play you a song, which something like Images is, you know, and I really love that. As a band, they've clearly come a long way from the kitchen sink approach of using samples that we got to send off the 80s and much more now incorporating it into these ideas. And I know they've been doing it for a little bit, but this is a great example of it. So I really like the atmosphere is building. Then we build into the actual song part of this song. And they hype us up for this exquisitely by just adding a little bit more energy to the percussion and introducing a few more swirly synths. And before you know it, like the apocryphal frog in the saucepan, you've been primed for this second act to where they finally get you. I think it's clear from the lyrics that we get that Hawkwind see the rise of TV viewership as another check on the downfall of humanity bingo card they've got. But, you know, they do it with some of their best lyric writing on the album, I think. It would be clearly beneath them just to say that TV is evil. So they send it up instead. They use the language of television to mock television, which is this great Hawkwind roast of TV. It's packed with zingers, like, you know, grazing with the handset is a great one to describe lazy channel hopping. And I love the fact they shout advertising slogans like hit pain where it hurts and you can't get better. And I quite like you can't get better because it's got that idea of either it's sampling someone saying you can't get better like a deal or you can't get better like you're addicted and there's no saving you. So I do like the fact that that can be taken two ways, which is great. A few of the lines don't hit quite so hard, like your fingers on the button, but who's got your soul is a little cheesy for me. But overall, it's a pretty decent critique of a human habit, which will only grow and become more of an issue as time goes on. So again, Hawkwind prescience is definitely here in the early 90s. And all the lyrics are read over this intense driving synth line, which keeps the tension high through the whole thing, as well as these chants from the other bandmates. And eventually the track hard cuts with the sound of smashing glass, which I interpret as the breaking of a TV set, giving the viewer their freedom back. And I say this because on the other side of the broken glass is this serene bit of instrumentation full of smooth keys, glittering, almost bit crushed effects on top, and this choral sounding pad that ebbs and flows peacefully for a few minutes before we slowly fade out into silence to complete the third act. Yeah, I think this track is arranged and paced wonderfully. From intro to story to denouement, it doesn't waste any time, gives you enough time with each part to get your brain thinking before switching it up, meaning by the end you've got this whole layer cake to mull over before the album makes good its escape. I think Hawkwind have ended albums really well before, and I think this is another one of their triumphs to round up the album.
I agree. I've always loved this track. And it was great fun to come back to, because definitely this was one that I latched onto, a bit like Out of the Shadows was one that I latched onto when I first had it. And I still love it. I love that beat. And as you say, that kind of metallic synth beat that's going on. I think Harvey, who would have written all of these lyrics, his spoken word delivery is something I like. It didn't get it very often. He obviously did Sonic Attack on Sonic Attack. And I quite liked his delivery of that, although, you know, it didn't win the tournament. But he does this really well. Even at the end, his delivery of the trust me line, I wait for it, basically, because I think it's so nicely delivered. And I love the instrumentation all the way through, the energy that it has. So yeah, this has always been a bit of a favorite of mine. And as an album closer, very, very strong, because the last track on an album is so important, isn't it, in terms of how you feel when the album concludes. Mm-hmm. A bit like when I was talking about Wings on side one and how it means that side one doesn't end that way for me, but fortunately, side two kicks off with Out of the Shadows. In this case, yeah, it rounds out beautifully and makes for a pretty strong second half of the album, I think. Obviously, there are five tracks on side two. There are three tracks on side one. So side two feels like it's the stronger of the two sides, but it's interesting to hear what you think and when we wrap up and conclude and then what everyone thinks afterwards. But first, The rest of the album story lies in the artwork. And the packaging for this really does very much suit the themes, I think, of the album. It does feel like it's quite a well-rounded concept, but this is different to some of the artwork we've spoken about so far, because this is a return to actually having a renowned album artist involved in putting this together. And that is Joe Patagno, P-E-T-A-G-N-O. So I'm guessing that's Patagno rather than Patagno. But either way, Joe, as we will call him, he's an American artist, and he has a huge amount of work to his name, including Led Zeppelin, Nazareth, Black Oak Arkansas, Roy Harper, a lot of bands in here. He's also got a lot of non-metal bands as well. Interestingly, if you know Led Zeppelin and you know Swan Song, the label they had, and the famous Zeppelin image, which is of the angel arching backwards, that apparently is Joe Patagno. And he also did some work with Hypnosis and worked on the original logo for Motorhead, i.e. the War Pig with the big tusks and the chain, and did album covers for the band as well. There are some really good videos actually online for Joe. If you look up on YouTube, Joe Patagno, Motorhead artist, there are two videos where he talks about designing the Motorhead logo and how his original sketches were more Hawkwindy than they turned out. And that's not what Lemmy wanted, which you can imagine he would have wanted to move away from that at the time. So Joe is a really interesting character and a full-on career album artist for major, major bands. What do you think of the cover art we have for Space Bandits, Matt?
It's a powerful image. I think this is one of the ones which, when I was starting to look for logo inspiration for us, I think I found this image. So I was wondering when it would show up. It's clearly a figure who's taking up a lot of the space, sat atop a kind of pile of what looks like looted junk, maybe. And then off to the side are the members of Hawkwind, as far as I can see. That looks very Brocky, the guy in the front, walking out of what looks like a crashed spaceship, which looks like the spaceship from Hall of the Mountain Grill. I was trying to figure out if they were trying to make some kind of canonical link between the two albums, and I'm not sure if there is a lot of that really sonically or thematically, or whether or not they just thought that would be a cool touch, like a deep cut for the fans. I'm not sure, but it's interesting that it's there. It's also the first time we've ever seen the band on an album. Character in front, he's very shamanistic. He looks like he could almost be the space black elk or something, you know, because he's got this very, I'm assuming it's a he. It looks male-esque. It could be human. It could be alien. I'm not sure. He's kind of pallid. He's a slight blue color. So who knows? But he's got glowing eyes. So, you know, not superhuman or superhuman, if you see what I mean. He's got this stick which has the hawk head on the top of it. So again, thematically fits, wearing this kind of crazy headdress with this big billowing around him. He looks like he could cast some kind of spell at you. I'm trying to figure out whether or not he's being snuck up on by the band, or whether or not they've crashed and they're looking for help and he just happens to be there and they're more tentatively trying to get his attention. You know, it's a difficult one to figure out. Is he the space bandit? Or because it's space bandits plural, are the band the space bandits and they're here to try and mug this guy for like his random stash?
I'd have thought they'd be very much on his side, personally. I suspect he represents something that they want. It's quite ambiguous, though.
It's open to interpretation, for sure. But it's very moody. You know, it's all the hues of burnt orange and greys and blues and the junk pile that the guy's sitting on. It's hard to really identify anything. The only thing I feel like I can see, and I don't know if I'm just imagining things, but in the bottom left-hand corner, there's what almost looks like a bomb, but that kind of... Do you remember when people used to draw like tiger's teeth and angry eyes on the front of planes and bombs, I think in like Vietnam or something? I almost see what looks like a cylinder with some of those tiger teeth there. But again, I don't know if I'm just imagining that.
It's very murky, but murky in a good way. Interestingly, the graphic that you found of the album for yourself to look at is much brighter and sharper than the vinyl cover art. This is much more smudged in terms of the detail and the outlines. I'll hold that up. It looks more like it's been done in crayon and then thumbed. Do you know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. So this is even murkier and darker than the graphic of the album cover that you tend to find out there. The album isn't quite as dark as the album cover suggests it will be. It's brighter than that. But thematically, it feels very, very on point. And in fact, when we were coming up with our Hawkbinge Season 3 artwork, when we ended up with our themes of the ancient paganistic combined with the high-tech future. That's taken from Hawkwind themes throughout the 90s. And this is actually not far off being quite on point for what we were looking at. Definitely good to see, because we liked the Xenon Codex cover. The Black Sword cover is unbelievably interesting, particularly once you get past the difficult colors on the original press of the album. We've definitely improved since Levitation, Sonic Attack, and those albums. We're doing more interesting things, and definitely a bit of a bold statement of intent on the front cover. And when we flick it over to the back cover, what do we have there?
This feels a little different to me, a little more lackluster somehow, I think. It's a smaller image because they've got information bars on the left and right, so fair enough. I think the thing's rendered fine as an image. It's kind of a strange series of pink mountains of which spacecraft are flying either into or out of. It feels like a very different place, you know, like it's much more colourful. It's much less foreboding somehow. It's got greenery in it. You know, it looks a lot more verdant and natural, where the other side feels a lot more industrial or scrap and junky and maybe polluted or sunsetty or something. You know, they feel very, very different. So I don't feel like the back particularly evokes the album either. This feels more at home in the 80s to me somehow. It feels a bit more pink and synthy and those kind of colours rather than the more grunge, which the 90s are going to be famous for, which we have on the front.
Yes, agreed. The back feels much cleaner and utopian is the wrong word, but certainly more hopeful than the front cover. But as a complete package, it wraps the content of the album quite well as a whole piece, would you say?
They put the right one on the front, for sure. I think that yes. The back's fine. It doesn't really imprint itself much in my brain. I could wonder what the spaceships are doing. I could wonder why they're there. I could wonder if there is a relationship between the two images to tell a story, but I just don't feel like it because I feel like the image isn't really doing much to really stoke my desire to do so, you know? Would have been great to have seen the Hall of the Mountain Grill ship fixed or something to get an idea of if that ship crashed and Brock and that are going to go and ask this guy if he's got some stuff that they can use to fix the ship with. If that is the Hawkwind, I guess we don't ever really know, but it's got the Hawkwind logo on it, doesn't it, on Hall of the Mountain Grill. So you could get the idea that maybe they've got it fixed and they're going to carry on with their journey or something. Could have been maybe a nice way to have finished off the back piece. So you kind of tell that story in two frames, but we did not do that. Instead, we got generic early Star Trek world.
Yeah, fairly arbitrary, I suppose you could say. The front cover seems to be really nice conceptually, got some good little Easter eggs in there, as you say, and fits thematically. And the back just seems to be, it's a nice image, but it's fairly arbitrary.
I just read that on the back, at least on the version that I saw, it says that actually 10% of the proceeds from Wings goes to the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds.
Oh, yes.
So actually, yeah, Wings is definitely a piece that was actually Hawkwind's probably first bit of actual activism that goes beyond pointing fingers and actually did something good.
Although I think they played a lot of free festivals and things. But yeah, in terms of raising money, I suppose. Well, I feel even more guilty about the fact that I didn't really like it now. Thanks for that. But yes, that is entirely right. That's on here as well. And I'd never picked it up before. Excellent. Well done then. So given all of that, that is the entirety of Space Bandits. How do you feel about that, Matt? What kind of conclusions are you drawing at the end of this massive task over many months of listening and re-listening to this music and studying it and all the rest? How do you feel about Space Bandits?
Definitely more hits than misses on this album. I find it hard to fully enjoy because of the first track. It's so all over the place. And like I said, it absorbs so much of my patience that by the time I get to the other tracks, I wasn't as charitable to them. So it did take quite a few complete listens for me to really start to appreciate the other tracks and what the whole album is. But when I did, all the other tracks opened up in front of me. And then unencumbered by the big attention grabbing track that was weighing it down, I enjoyed it a lot more. And I thought it was able to really engage with me in a much stronger way, a much deeper way. I think the quality of the recording and the performances of the album is really good. there isn't really a track on it which I think lacks good production. You know, sometimes you feel like one was done in a studio, then one was done in a garage, then one was done somewhere else, and it becomes difficult to feel like there's a consistent production tone. Obviously, Levitation didn't have that, but some of the others have, and I feel like this is much more consistent, which helps it feel like an album and helps move through the tracks from beginning to end in a pleasing way. I'm still perplexed by how much Brock is hiding on this album, but his absence certainly doesn't ruin the record. I think that's just more something that I was surprised about. So I think on the whole, it's a good variety pack from Hawkwind to start the new decade and our new season. It certainly gave us a lot to talk about. We've definitely had enough to say about this than we have for a lot of the albums. So, you know, it gave me a lot to write about and think about as I listened. Definitely there's tracks on here which I will feel very happy about adding to the chronology of the podcast. So yeah, I think it's a good start to the decade, and I wonder where they're going to go.
It is a strong start to the decade for sure. There's a bit of a statement of intent, I think, in it. I find it to be a little bit patchier. I quite like the package of Xenon Codex without necessarily thinking that there is a legendary track in there. With Space Bandits, which I haven't gone back to as much as I did Xenon Codex, there are tracks on Space Bandits that I prefer to anything on Xenon Codex. But the album as a whole, I hadn't felt was as strong as Xenon Codex. I'm kind of rethinking that a little bit, mainly because of Side 2, which I've really grown into on this journey we've been on. I really like the flow across Side 2, and it's really Side 1 that I find slightly patchy. But mainly because you've got three songs there, the middle one of which I like the entirety of, the last one I struggle with a bit, and the first one I like bits of. So it's less consistent in that way. I'm slightly surprised at how much I enjoy when you get past the halfway mark, how that flow of songs on Side 2 works out. Even the ones which I think on paper would be regarded as slightly more average tracks or meh filler tracks or whatever, I find that they actually really work for me. Interestingly, as a wrap-up, and I don't know how informative this is, but one last time going back to Ian's book, there is a comment by someone called Roy Wilkinson. I don't know where this comes from, but he says it's an album of two halves, although I'm not sure if he's seeing it the same way I am in terms of those two halves. But he says the first half has the plausibility of the original version of Flash Gordon. By Side 2, they've acquired the high-tech authenticity of, ooh, a really good episode of Blake 7. I'm hearing it the other way around, quite frankly, says Ian, which I would agree with. But in the final analysis, it's a starting point for a new era, but not a fully rounded mission statement. That feels about right to where I am. I think, interestingly, neither of us are negative on this album. I think you're slightly more positive on it than I am. But it's definitely been a fascinating one to dive back into. And with that, what are you going to add to the Hawk Binge Master Playlist?
I think I'm going to disappoint you, Andy, because I want to put Wings on.
Okay.
I know. I still think that after everything, there's something about it which is almost Hawkwind's best 80s track is in the 90s, with the way that this sounds and the way that it behaves.
Interesting.
For some reason, despite everything that should put me off, it kind of compels me. Maybe just because this is something that I remember as a kid, I don't like the context, but obviously I respond to the context more. And it just sounds like something which I haven't really heard them do. And it's also a way of acknowledging our new singer without putting images on, which was not going to happen. So that's my reasons for logging it. Beyond just my liking of it, I still think it's one that deserves its acknowledgement.
Fair. That sounds good to me. Okay, I will accept that. And I will ask you what is going to be added to Wings, its companion piece on the Hawk Binge Sessions playlist, which I imagine is a brand new playlist, isn't it, for season 3. We're starting a new one.
Yeah, I think we're up to 6 now, and this will be starting the new one, because even though 5 was shorter, we wanted to drop it just to finish the season. Yeah. So joining, it's going to be TV Suicide. While I know it's disappointing to not have Out of the Shadows, I'm sorry. There is a live version. So if we ever do a 90s wrap up, I could try there and get it in there for you, because I do like it. But again, when I think about what I like documenting about Hawkwind and what still calls to me is that when they do these little think pieces and they do them well, I really want to call attention to them. And I think that this track has an almost reverse Iron Dream ending, which I love. It has them doing this kind of music concrete properly, which I respect, which isn't, you know, Good Evening, which is at the beginning. And then in the middle, there is some nice lyric work and some interesting thinking, talking about part of the human condition, which has not gone away and has only grown and become more problematic. So I think it's a good thing to see that before really like the second wave of MTV, before social media, before IMAX and all that, Hawkwind was still looking at the Gogglebox with a side eye, thinking like, this can only mean trouble. And arguably they were right. So I think that definitely means that it belongs in the Sessions playlist.
I like these choices for the simple reason that Hawk Binge is about you coming to this music baggage free and making your decisions without knowing what everybody else thinks and what the, you know, received wisdom is. So these are your tracks, and the master playlist is other tracks that you've really connected with on the journey. So that works for me. One day, maybe I'll do my own playlist called Out of the Shadows, containing Out of the Shadows. But for now, those work perfectly well. So one thing that we like to do on Hawk Binge, and we've done for all the albums so far, is to see where the album that we're dealing with actually kind of ranks with wider Hawkwind fandom. There is no objective list. I mean, there's no objective list for any band, but there is a resource we can use, which is a bit of a litmus test, I guess. At least it's a big enough group of people. You can have some belief in the validity of the results. And this is the result of polls run by Elric Newby on the Hawkwind Fans Worldwide Facebook group for all sorts of different things. But they ranked all the albums. People listed their favorite albums. Elric produced those as a bit of a league table. And then at the suggestion of some clever people, put that out as a little book that you can buy, which is not why he did it, but it's quite a nice thing to have. And Space Bandits comes in at number 23. Now, number 23 actually is including live albums, compilations, and all that. There are a lot of those, let's face it. So if you take all those out, Space Bandits, it nets at number 19 in the list of Canon Studio albums, which, given that there were, at the time that that book was done, probably 32 maybe albums, it's about two-thirds down, which is slightly surprising to me. It's one position above Xenon Codex, but it's below both 25 Years On and Church of Hawkwind. So a little bit of a surprise, but then one never completely agrees with any of these things, do they? But it's interesting to see where a group of that kind of size rates the album. Number 19 is where that nets out. So there you go. Matt, this has been an excellent, fun return to doing Canon episodes. I'm now really looking forward to doing these for the rest of the 90s. Also, because a lot of the 90s were my Hawkwind wilderness years. So it's going to be really interesting for me revisiting this stuff, just as much as it is seeing how all this stuff connects with you.
Cool. Yeah, I think we put our best foot forward, and I think that Hawkwind have too. So I'm looking forward for what happens next.
Agreed. And we will be getting to Electric Teepee. So you can see that this continuation of the tribal and the tech continues into the next album. But hopefully this will find you all well. We look forward to hearing from you all and getting your take on Space Bandits and where you agree and disagree with us both. And then we will dive into our Electric Teepees as soon as we possibly can. Technicians of Spaceship Earth, you have been listening to Hawk Binge, the Hawkwind podcast. It was devised and presented by Andy Hood and Matt Longstaff. The soundtrack was produced by Dissonant. To contact the show, drop us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, by searching at Hawkbinge, or send an email to podcast@hawkbinge.space. Hawkbinge is a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. To find more great band and music-focused podcasts like this one, head to @deepdivepodnet on Twitter and dive in. Thank you, as always, for listening. We'll see you next time.